the network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
This is The Live Life, Episode 5, Beachfront Property, recorded September 13th, 2012. Another edition of The Live Life. This is episode 5. Today, we're going to talk about, well, something that is so ubiquitous in the event world that sometimes we take it for granted, I think. It's almost akin to the guy saying, well, it's just a wire. What are we talking about? We're talking about RF, the radio frequency wireless mics. I'm going to make a bold statement at the beginning to say, like anything wireless, it is one of the most convenient methodologies for transferring that voice or data over. It's also one of the most inconsistent and irksome things to ever be created. I started with RF only because I was a test bench guy for a company called Scharf Weisberg, and they said, well, we need mics tested here. And back in those days, you did everything. You did as you were told. And we got into bigger and bigger systems. And it was a nice little interesting way of learning stuff. And finding that information was one of the things that is still resonant in my head. I had to do it by finding manufacturers' manuals, manufacturers' white papers, the occasional instruction somewhere in a library. Because back then in the 92, 93, the internet wasn't quite the beast it is today. And while you could find almost anything, a lot of it wasn't there. One of the people that I started off with, and we'll start the introductions here, is Cliff Pospisil. Cliff is a former Scharf Weisberg employee who specialized in RF. He does RF currently. Hey, Cliff, how are you?
I'm doing great. How you doing, George?
All right. Also joining us today is Ben Escobedo. Did I do that right?
Hey, you got it.
Yeah. All right, close enough. He is with Sennheiser.
That's right.
And we have Chris Regan. Chris also appeared on our Live show live from Infocom a couple of months ago. How are you, Chris?
Doing great. Thanks for having me, George.
And Chris is from, I did say RF Venue. Yes, I did. Also with us today is Mike Weber. Mike Weber is from Peter Schmidt Company. They are a wireless company, and I believe they are a representative of Shure.
How are you doing?
All right. And, of course, my ever-present co-host, Mike Postapuck. How are you, sir?
Hello, everybody, and happy September to you. I guess it's time to put down the suntan lotion and pick up the Leatherman, huh? September's here.
And don't confuse the two.
It really
hurt.
Ouch.
Either you're not going to loosen that bolt, or it's going to hurt. Nice. Well, all right, gentlemen, so we're assembled here with an enormous brain trust of individuals who know RF. Oh, I'm sorry, and I forgot Andrew Guberman.
Yeah.
Andrew, I work with Andrew. He's right down on the bench from me. Of course, I forgot him. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, George.
We got a great bunch of guys here today.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, I'm going to pay for that one tomorrow, I'm sure. Actually, I'm in the New York City office tomorrow, Andrew, so you'll have to wait till Monday.
Oh, I'm out all next week, so.
Oh, there you go.
So it'll be sometime soon. I'll set a calendar appointment.
Oh man! So let's talk with start with you, Mike, Mr. Postapuck. You are a small shop that deals with venues, but you have to deal with wireless as well, right?
Oh yeah.
And what is your average wireless system? What is it that you are always dealing with?
Looking 6 to 8 units, maybe 10. You know, I do, you know, your basic ballroom stuff. You know, 1,000 people or something. So yeah, I would say pretty much 6 units. I have to say I'm using the Shures a lot. I do like the Sennheisers. I've used them quite a few times. But we do have the Shure units and it's just something that we liked because, you know, we could sub-rent easily and lots of people have them and things like that if we need, you know, to go up. But I'll tell you, you know, the Sennheisers are really nice, too. I do like them.
Well, but what are your common issues? I mean, you're on site, you're in the DC area. What is it like you're the most common thing that you just frustrate?
Well, you know, there's always the everyday thing where you got to make sure that you don't have the crosstalk with the in-house company and all that kind of stuff, okay? But the other thing is and actually I wanted to ask these gentlemen if they maybe, you know, I'll ask this stupid question here because, you know, this is how I learn. Let's take, for instance, the cell phone in the jacket pocket while they're wearing the wireless microphone. Is this like a frequency problem, or is this something that like shielding can help? You know, is there something to do? Can we help somehow?
I can comment on this.
Yeah, go ahead, Ben.
No problem. The basically the RF energy that's given off from a typical GSM, typically cell phone, excites the microphone capsule itself. So it's not normally an RF thing. It's more of it makes the capsule make that kind of weird sounds. And you know what I'm talking about. It kind of goes dee 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 dee, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's really a proximity effect of having that cell phone in the breast pocket or close to the lavalier mic or another type of microphone. The bottom line is you got to move that away from the cell phone away from the microphone for that to go away.
There's no like preventative trick that can be done in case the guy forgot to take his phone out. You know, we always tell the presenter, you know, hey, you know, do you have a phone? Please take it out and all that. But you know, someone's gonna put one back in there every once in a while. And is there something that you could do to try and prevent that otherwise?
I wish I could say there was. It would do the same thing with a wireless or wired mic. So basically, sure, moving it apart is the only real recourse in my experience.
Well, I got to tell you, that's actually new to me because I actually did think it was some kind of harmonic or some kind of, you know, frequency getting through the filters. But it's actually a physical moving of the diaphragm.
Basically, not physical, but it does leak enough energy into the coils and such to actually cause the noise.
But typically, I would say that's being induced right into the microphone cable. Hmm. You're radiating about 700 milliwatts right next to that cable. It's a very low level coming from the capsule. And so that's just RFI is what that is, getting right into your mic cable.
Well, I know
hearing data. You're hearing the data from the carrier. That's what that ticking is.
All right, so Gil, back up for a second, Cliff. Let's, for some of our audience, describe what that carrier is and how it differs from, say, the audio signal in the wireless mic.
The carrier is just data, so it's not going to sound like audio. And so that's what it sounds like. Basically, if you were to listen to it in an audio, like an analog environment, it's going to sound just like ticking, I would say.
So, RF carriers for cell phones are not that far apart from the UHF bands that we use to transmit audio frequencies.
Right. So for the audience, though, and you know, because we're all guys who've dealt with a little bit of this, but so we have a carrier and then we have the modulated signal, right?
Right.
Right. So the difference between those two, the carrier is your set frequency that we then do something to, correct?
Right.
Yes.
The carrier is a signal that's several thousand times the frequency that we can hear. So the audible frequency range is from 10 cycles or 20 cycles up to about 20,000 cycles, and we call those hertz. The range that we normally use, there's actually several different ranges that can be used for wireless transmission. The most common in the professional world is between 470 and about 698 megahertz. So it's megahertz as opposed to kilohertz. It's a thousands of times high above the range of our human hearing.
Right, and then that base signal is then added through the electronics. This signal that the voice is added in a modulated fashion to that signal, correct?
For analog transmission, that's correct. And
sure,
there's also digital ways of doing this, which we can get to later.
Okay, sure. And what I wanted to establish for some of the listeners here and stuff is that there are two, or at least one signal, and that's sort of different from just the audio signal, and there's a sort of mechanics to that because we progress into more about RF.
Right. So the carrier is basically a fixed frequency that we don't hear, and then we modulate it with audio. The transmitter modulates the carrier, the receiver demodulates it and extracts the audio back out.
Right. And for those, most people should be understanding that if I can be so bold as to say, it's almost like a D to A and A to D converter, the digital analog to digital stuff most of our audio guys are familiar with.
You could use that analogy.
Yeah, there's a lot more going on inside of it. It's doing a lot more manipulation of the signal, but yeah. So is I'll ask the question out loud here. Is the carrier the main thing that we're worried about when we're saying I have 6, 8, 20, 48 channels of RF that I have to concern myself with in a room?
Well, right. Yes. Ben,
go ahead.
Yeah, the carrier is basically the home base frequency of where the signal is being modulated around. So if you're going to be describing your frequencies in terms of where they're at in megahertz, for example, then yes, the carrier would be what you'd use to say, you know, I'm at 518 megahertz and I got one at 530 megahertz and so forth. Yes.
So on larger shows, you know, Mr. Postbuck mentioned, you know, he has six and, you know, he has to worry about the house frequencies or possibly stuff from outside, maybe even cabs, although that's probably less likely these days. You can correct me on that.
VHS days, though, boy, holy cow. I remember them at the World Trade Center. Man, it was bad.
Well, New York City is RF hell. Mm-hmm. Like, is there any major urban area? Well, you're in D.C., for goodness sakes. You have the NSA. There must be more frequencies there than, than can be humanly consumed. I'm going to throw the question to Andrew, Mr. Guberman.
Yes.
You and I talked this afternoon about you had something you were going on with 48 frequencies, right?
Yes, that's going to be coming up next week.
Okay, so you were working on that. So take us through really quickly what you go through in order to say, okay, I've got an order for this many units. I think this is for an install, but it can apply to a live event.
This is actually for a live show.
Okay, good.
But it's. So the first thing you need to know is you need to ideally scan your room to see what DTV is in the air or what other, you know, things are going on around you. And if you can't do that, at least you can go to various websites. I know Sennheiser has it. I'm pretty sure Shure will have it on their website where you can at least get the DTV in the area. You know, you can put in your zip code and that'll at least get you started as to what to avoid.
Well, what is putting the zip code gets me what?
The various DTV transmissions that are in the air, you know, just as a baseline. So, you know, if you don't know that, you're very likely to go in and be programmed to a frequency that you can't use. In a city like New York, there's a lot of DTV in the air. So you have to avoid that as, you know, your starting point, and then you can start programming and coordinating from there. So in order to do that, there are various frequency coordination programs, because with that many channels, you want to make sure that you don't interfere with yourself, such as, you know, if I have three mics, they each combine to cause other harmonics the same way. You can kind of think of it like harmonics in music that might affect a fourth mic.
All right, so let's stop for one second, and I don't mean to interrupt your train of thought, but let's also remember, okay, let's talk about the harmonics in RF. What are we dealing with right there?
Well, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Well, harmonics, basically we're describing, we call it intermodulation. And we're mainly concerned with the third order and the fifth order harmonics because they're the strongest that result from two frequencies. Two frequencies reacting together, as Andrew described, will put out a third, a fifth, a seventh, and a ninth even. But the third and the fifth harmonics will be a certain range away. And if you put another frequency on top of where that harmonic is being generated, that can cause some interference, most commonly in the form of small intermittent dropouts and static hits and things of that nature.
Right. So the guitar string example would work here, right? That you just pluck a guitar string and it makes not just the one tone, but several others, which are harmonics of that frequency, right? So these are things sort of generated outside of that main carrier or main frequency that you generated that are sort of propagating outwards that could affect anything else around you.
That's precisely right, George. Okay. You got to be on a free and open frequency that's not occupied by a DTV station or another source, and then you also have to coordinate and space these frequencies apart, not equidistant, but so that the harmonics don't overlap on the other frequencies you're using. As you can imagine, it gets a lot more complicated the more frequencies you have. Two frequencies, not a big deal. Three, okay, you got to be careful, and then it exponentially gets harder to find spaces to put these where it's not only free, but you're not on top of a harmonic that's being generated.
Right. So, and you guys have provided me here in the little notes with both Shure and with Sennheiser's frequency finder tools. We'll post those up on the show post with the show notes so everyone can have access to them. I know I've used them, and they're fantastic little tools. So if we're going to do with these little frequency finders, then Andrew, or I'll throw it to Cliff at this point. Cliff, we've gone over our sheet of frequencies, right? And we've gone over what we think is in a room, what's in our location. Then we're going to have to probably do a scan, as Andrew said. But what are we using to scan those things? And as a side note, by the way, Cliff actually started off as an intern at Scharf Weisberg, and one of the first things we had him do was be the wireless walker, which meant he was the guy that had to walk around as we were testing it going 1, 2, so we could test every single mic set together and record them to make sure they weren't pop. And he grew into doing this, and we used to have this enormous binder, right, Cliff? It's a great binder filled with everything we could possibly find on frequencies in New York to ensure that the show in, say, some studio or out in the park would work. So to recap, we've got the frequency sets. We've looked at them. We think we're okay. We've done the Sennheiser the Shure frequency math. But we're going to do a scan anyway, right? What are we using and why are we using it?
Well, basically, there's a number of things you can use. What's really nice these days is that a lot of times you can use the receivers themselves to scan the environment that they're operating in. A lot of them have scanners in there. They'll even tell you where to put the mics, you know, because they're looking at everything from the antenna that they're using. So it's really gotten a lot easier. I mean, the days that you were just talking about where we were doing like the days of like Turbo RF, this is way before really great programs came out to help us coordinate RF. But you can go out and buy a handheld portable scanner. There's a number of things on the market depending on what you're doing, you know?
But basically,
you need a spectrum analyzer.
That prompts a question in my mind, if you don't mind. The auto frequency finders and all that on the wireless mics, and when they find a channel, how accurate is that? I mean, can you trust that 100% that's a good channel that it found? I know Sennheiser you can, of course, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, Sennheiser here. Yeah. I actually can't speak for that. To tell you, I'm just going to. I've never used that feature of the receivers, but I know they offer it. I always had the tools to look at it other ways.
So we'll throw it to Ben.
Sure, absolutely. Both the Sennheiser and the Shure units, we have a certain number of preset frequencies that are automatically coordinated, or if you use those sets of frequencies, Sennheiser calls them banks and Shure calls them groups. And those preset frequencies are automatically guaranteed to be intermodulation free if you use them all in the same bank or the same group. For example, bank 1, channel 1, bank 1, channel 2, and so forth, or group 2, channel 1, group 2, channel 2, and so forth. The auto scanning ability is a great tool. However, it's not infallible. I mean, it could be just based on where you do the scan. You may be missing a frequency that if you move 10 feet to the left, it could be a problem. But for the most part, they're pretty reliable. And on any system, like Cliff was saying, you can actually look at the RF meter with the transmitter off on the receiver and look at how much RF or how much activity you're getting. It's kind of like bars of reception on your cell phone. And with the transmitter off, you should be seeing empty. If you're seeing empty, there's probably a pretty good chance that channel's free. If that RF meter is dancing around with your transmitter switched off, you know there's going to be an issue. But to come back to the original question, the scanning ability is pretty good and has excelled over the years. It's not infallible. It's not the end all. But if you do use it properly, it will go a long way in getting a good coordination.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, the one thing you do have to worry about when using a scan feature is if you have other devices such as communications or in-ear monitors that are not in that scan, you know, it's only going to coordinate for that unit or those groups of units that are networked.
Precisely
particularly
right.
The two-way communication devices are particularly problematic because they're not always on.
Yeah, that is good. That's a good, very good point. Thanks for bringing that up.
Well, then we get to, the RF equivalent of hum heads, which are, you know, named such because they're always chasing a hum somewhere, right? And, you know, the same thing with RF. We're always chasing some kind of itinerant frequency that got in the way and suddenly put a zap in the middle of, you know, nobody else. But, of course, when the CEO goes up to speak halfway through a speech, there's what, one hit, right? I'll put that to let's put this to you, Cliff. All right. All right. Actually, Mike, let's ask you. In setting this up, we've gone through some of this process of, you know, we've done our research. We know that we have a frequency set. We know we've done a little check with the zip code on one of the frequency checkers. We've done a list of what's in-house. We know some of the local frequencies. We've done a scan, but we're getting this occasional hit, right? What's our option inside this venue, given that it's a pre-show, so we're not quite in live yet? But what are some of the things we can do to say, I can help eliminate or minimize that effect?
You didn't say which mic.
Well, what if we don't know at that point? Let's start there.
Yeah, no, go ahead, Mike Weber. Oh, Mike Weber, sorry. You guys are the experts on this. Go ahead.
Right. Well, so first of all, Shure has a great free tool called Wireless Workbench Software, and I'm going to send the link to that. With the Wireless Workbench Software, you can do several things. First of all, you can access the FCC database to download, you know, what are the UHF television channels, DTV channels that are operating in that area. Secondly, you can add your inventory. If it's Shure products, it all networks together, the higher level Shure products, and when you network it together, the Wireless Workbench Software sees those products and identifies them and what frequencies they're on and populates the inventory. But you can also add third-party products. You can add the Sennheiser products, the two-way communications devices, any other wireless that is in the vicinity and may or may not be identified by the scan. So we can enter that information so that when we coordinate our frequencies, we're taking all that into account.
Let me ask a question, actually. One that comes to mind here is, we talked about, you know, shutting off the transmitter and looking on the receiver and seeing if it's getting any bars going on over there. I have seen people who just can't find the channel and they got like one, you know, one bar happening there and they're using it that way and have not had a problem. Is that like way dangerous or, you know, is that, how bad is that?
If you're only showing one bar at the very bottom of that RF meter, you're probably going to be fine as long as you're within good range and your antennas are properly aimed and located. Because typically the signal from your transmitter is going to be lighting up the RF ladder pretty close to the top, and you've got plenty of headroom there.
Mm. One thing I would add, this is Chris, is that I think a lot of times, and we see this as an analog coming out of audio systems, is that people kind of get fixated around gain, and that, you know, maximum gain, maximum signal level is paramount over everything else. And in the RF domain, that's not necessarily the case. Really what you want is signal quality and signal constancy, which is not necessarily the same thing as, you know, maximum gain. In a lot of cases, you know, in certain cases where we run into where, you know, the front end of a receiver is being overloaded and we find that the person is using an active antenna really close range with a really input transmitter. And so, you know, in a lot of applications, and again, because it's RF, you know, your mileage will absolutely 100% vary. But in a lot of applications, you know, range and gain and signal level aren't really all created equal. For instance, if you are operating at a trade show, and we do a lot of work with AV companies and other folks that operate at trade shows, and I can send you some scans actually from the Infocom show where we demonstrated this. If you're using even just back of your receiver, or much less a higher gain unit like a paddle antenna, you're picking up tons of other RF that you do not need to be sending to your receiver, because you don't need to operate the mic necessarily in the entire trade show hall. You really just want good quality, good signal to noise over everything else. So, you know, gain and signal level need to be sort of, you know, I think taken with a grain of salt in a lot of applications, particularly if you just have a talking head on a stage that wants a wireless lav set up because he wants to move his hands around. It's not because you can't get a wire up there.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great point, Chris, because I mean, I have seen sound guys who are thinking, you know, just like you said, you know, gain is good. And they go ahead and they're turning up the gain on the paddles. And just like you said, what it's actually doing, it's making it easier to pick up all the trash that's in the room there because it's on the high gain now. So that is a great point to bring up.
Exactly. The main danger of using a frequency that is maybe mildly in use is that when you shut the transmitter off, the thing will open up and you'll hear a crazy amount of just like white noise or static. This has got to be the number one complaint we hear on the technical support line, mostly from users that aren't, you know, searching for frequencies. You just turn it on and expect it to work. Everything may be working great when you're in close proximity to the receiver, but as soon as you turn that off, it's picking up a digital TV station or something, and then all that crazy noise comes through and everything's nutty. Mm-hmm. I was at an install not too long ago, troubleshooting in Boston at a very high-profile bank. I think they're running about 16 channels in this mega conference room and everything, and they were having that same problem. They would shut the transmitters off, and all of a sudden they would break squelch, and they would hear this crazy noise. And of course, when the CEO of the bank is there, you can't be having this. And we're tracing out things. I'm asking them questions, and how's your antennas looking? And you know, sure enough, they had boosters on their antennas. And I'm like, well, you know, why do you have your boosters there? And again, like Chris was saying, you know, people think that more gain is better. These boosters are not only amplifying the signal, but they're amplifying all the noise floor as well. So when you shut the transmitter off, the noise floor is now accelerated, and it's going to be picked up as just kind of noise through the system, or actually audible static. We took the boosters out of the system, brought the noise floor down, and pretty much solved the problem. So, you know, too much gain is never good. The boosters and active antennas should be used in a manner to make up for losses in the cable run, but never to compensate over that. Absolutely.
That is great. I'm glad we brought that up, because I'll tell you, there are a lot of guys who really don't understand that out there. With that in mind, the paddles, right? The paddles are directional. Is that correct?
We offer both. There are both types.
Mm-hmm.
And hold on 1 second, guys. I just want to do a reminder that you are listening to the Live Life episode 5. Joining us today is Ben Escobedo from Sennheiser, Mike Weber from Peter Schmidt, Cliff Pospisil, who's an RF engineer, Christopher Regan from RF Venue. I almost got that wrong. Sorry, Chris. And Andrew Gooberman from World Stage, along with Mike Postapuck, my co-host, and I, who I almost never mention myself in these things. I am George Tucker from World Stage as well, and AV Nation. So, Chris, Mike P. asked a question there about antennas and the paddles. You guys specialize in antennas, and this is a big issue, I think, that I don't think a lot of people actually know how they're supposed to set up their antennas. And I'll preamble that question with, long ago, and the last time I was an active RF technician or engineer was 10 years ago, much too long ago. And one of the tricks that a company that I think that's now out of business, Vega, taught me with the UHF, the brand new UHF units, was take my hand, make a Y, like a sign language Y, and pop the two antennas apart that distance. You would need a quarter wave distance between your antennas in order to do the true diversity and all this other stuff. I'm told that's a myth. You know, educate us a little bit on antenna placement.
Yeah, well, we take a little bit of a different approach in terms of directional antennas with the diversity fin, which is a combination of two different kinds of antenna. It kind of runs counter to actually a lot of the theory on using equal gain antennas spaced apart as a function of the wavelength of the frequencies that you're operating at. Typically you want to space out paddle antennas about a quarter wave apart. But you know, what we've found is that having two of the same antenna on the same axis, so you know, the vertical and horizontal domains play a real part spatially here. If you sort of picture a handheld mic up on stage moving around and all the various reflections that are happening in the room, you can appreciate this. Or if you've ever had a sudden dropout when the talent takes the mic from vertical to horizontal, that can be a serious problem and a big cause of dropouts. So it's not necessarily, like I was saying earlier, gain or you know, having something spaced 3 feet apart instead of 15 feet apart, it's actually the orientation of the transmitter that can be causing that dropout. So you know, one of the things that we advocate and we do try to specialize a little bit in is that reducing the total power and placing the antenna and integrating the antenna as close as you can to the area of operation is advisable. Now, you know, in our case with the RF spotlight, we, you know, that has to go within a very limited range, say 100 feet of diameter operating range where you're going to be using your wireless. And of course, this isn't always possible to run coax right across a stage. So, you know, absent that ability to really come in close, reduce the power of your output transmitters, reduce the output power of your transmitters, and really focus in the reception of your desired devices to a limited area. You know, spacing paddle antennas back at a front of house position a number of feet, or absolutely, you know, bringing in higher gain antennas as required in very large facilities like helicals is a good thing to do. But it's you have to also consider that spatial orientation. So you might want to position one paddle vertical, one paddle horizontal, both paddles at 45 degrees. It's really one of those things that you want to put in a checklist when you're testing out your RF is the antenna position, because that can really affect the performance of the system. And again, I stress that, you know, your mileage may vary, and that the ability to be flexible and try out different scenarios will go a long way, because not every room is the same on the same day. Because of a lot of these reflections and other intermittent sources of interference.
So in that conversation, you mentioned like lowering power and using active paddles or active antennas. Could you, just for us, there's a passive and an active antenna. What's really the difference at its core? What's going on there with an active antenna?
Well, what's going on with an active antenna is that you have active electronics amplifying the signal at the antenna. Okay, so use a antenna distributor or you know, certain kinds of receiver, you'll actually have power out over that coax that will drive that amplifier at the active antenna. You can almost immediately identify active paddle antennas because you'll see a little sort of module that's attached. Usually has a little indicator light that comes on, and that'll boost the signal by some degree. But as I think one of the panelists mentioned earlier, that is really most helpful when you have a very long cable run, because cable runs and long runs of coax are very lossy depending on what type, length, et cetera. So if you're running, you know, 100 plus feet and you have some lossy cable, that can be a great way to make sure you don't lose too much signal. Now, alternatively, a passive system, which is, I would say, the majority of paddle antennas, helical antennas, certainly our entire line, because it's something that I think we sort of steer people towards instead of accidents, don't have that. So any loss that you're going to incur over the coax cable is something that is going to lower your signal level. But again, if you come back to the antenna position and if you've thought about bringing the antenna in closer, that proximity effect is going to play a big part.
Yeah, and again, proximity, like all the things in audio, proximity means a lot, right? Andrew?
Yes.
So Chris is talking a lot about the antennas and long runs. Here's something you and I have both encountered in questions with people. 75 ohm versus 50 ohm coax cable for antennas. It's not different. Why does it matter?
Well, every cable has an impedance and something where it wants to operate. And RF likes 50 ohms, whereas video operates at 75 ohms. RF wants to operate on a 50 ohm cable. It travels better and has a lot less loss at that impedance.
And I think a lot what we see with some of the guys who've only dealt with this is that 50 ohm cable is what they get their cable TV in, but they think that's 75 ohm. Because it's video, right? I mean, this is a conversation I've had with people. Now, can you use 75 ohm cable? I'm in a panic. They didn't send me the right thing. Can I do it? What's going to happen?
Well, you could get away with it if you really had to, but you're going to have a lot less range on your system, and it's not going to perform as well.
Right. So does it depend upon the length also? Will that make a difference? In if you have to use a video cable, if you try to use a shorter one, will that, be better?
That's again going to be better than if you're using, 100 foot or 200 foot 75 ohm cable. That's going to be pretty bad. But, if you have a 10 footer, you're going to get some reception, but it's not going to perform nearly as well as if you're using the correct 50 ohm cable. Mm-hmm. And when you look at 50 ohm cable, you still have many different varieties that have all different levels of loss. So just for lack of a better way to describe it, there's thicker cable and there's thinner cable. And the thicker cable is usually going to have a thicker center pin. Mm-hmm. And that's going to get you a lot better signal strength. But the one problem with that can be a little bit tough to deal with, coiling it up. If you're doing live shows at the end of the night, it's not necessarily the nicest cable to coil.
So how long a run can you do? I mean, with 50 ohm cable can work. Can you be, have a tech area in the back of the ballroom, let's say you really needed for some reason to get your antennas way up front, they needed to be close for some reason. Can you run it 100, 200 feet, around the ballroom to the back and it still work well?
I'm going to toss that one to Mike Weber. Mike, you want to take a chance at that?
Sure. It really depends on the quality of the cable. A high quality cable, you can absolutely run 200 feet. With the proper amplification, if necessary, you could run more than that. At 500 feet, if you had to. But again,
you definitely would need a booster, though, of some sort.
At that point, you most likely would need a booster, and you would definitely want to use the best quality, such as RG8X, not the cheaper RG8 or RG8U. I get those confused sometimes, so forgive me. Maybe one of you guys want to help me out.
I would even go for 9913, which is a thicker cable, or 9913F7 is more flexible. But there are many different types of cables made.
Right. Your cable, the loss in all the cables can be calculated very accurately. So, I mean, RF, as you talked about, it's all about gain structure. So if you know how long the cable is, you can establish an amplifier to give you the right amount of gain or an antenna to give you the right amount of gain. It's all about gain structure. That's really important.
Yeah, and the takeaway here is that, yes, beforehand you want to plan this all out and if you have the opportunity to. But, of course, if you're on site and it's 1 hour to going in and you realize the shop sent you video cable, not antenna cable, you can make some accommodations for it. Just be aware that you have to sort of proximity effect. All right, I guess this is the old adage is what? Location. So it's where you are. Cliff, one of the things I want to talk to you about is that when Cliff was at Sharp Weisberg, I sort of left after tenure and then came back, and Cliff promptly left just as I arrived. And one of the things that you did as I was looking at your Facebook page in all those years is you did a lot of outdoor sporting events in general. That's an outside thing, right? So my presumption is that indoors there may be some protection from the outside RF. I know it goes through walls and everything else like cosmic rays, but you would presume that, if I'm in the ballroom way in the back, deep in the bowels of the building, I may have some more protection against these extraneous RF. But you're out in the middle of a football field, direct right. on a site to New York City. Take us through that. I mean, what goes on in these big, big events that you have to cover this entire venue? I mean, what are we doing?
Well, first, if you're outside, obviously you're not getting shielding. There's two ways of looking at it. Indoor events offer you shielding from some of the local transmitters and things like that, like television transmitters. But they also, there's a lot more reflections going on. So you have to take into consideration your third order harmonics and, that kind of thing. Outdoors, you don't really have to worry too much about the reflections, but you really want to make sure, depending on how large this is, if you're talking a football stadium and you need to, you know, your antenna is 200 feet away from your transmitter, you're going to want to make sure that you got a nice clean frequency and try to make sure that you're that it's coordinated well, so you're not going to pick up noise from, you know, other people using wireless equipment.
Yeah, and that's my question, because now you're in an outdoor venue where the general public comes in, and as we started this conversation with the microphones, the cell phones, it's, you know, not literally on that frequency. But so that accumulation doesn't matter, that RF noise of everything and everybody, or is it really just so irrelevant proximity-wise and power-wise that it...
Well, cell phones typically won't interfere with our UHF stuff. They do obviously interfere with data networks in the 2.4 gigahertz area, things like that, depending on the building and stuff. But for our UHF stuff, like you're talking about the mics that we're talking about, they really don't affect it too much, I found.
So, and just to be clear for some of the people out there, reflections. We've used the term a couple of times. Audio guys probably know what this is and understand the angle of incidence is equal to the angle of attack and all this stuff. But just give us a brief overview, Cliff, of why reflections matter and what they cause and why they're troublesome.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to like the antenna placement and antenna, all of that. I mean, you have theoretical, you know, theories about where these antennas should be placed wavelength. But if you throw them into a building, you know, the wavelengths are so short, they're bouncing all over. So you're literally getting as much reception from reflected waves as you are from the direct, you know, carrier coming from the transmitter. So sometimes, depending on the type of antenna, you can get phase cancellations, you know, things like that. But yeah, reflections actually help you a lot in certain parts of the spectrum, depending on the equipment you're using. Sometimes you rely on reflections to get that equipment to actually operate better.
And what are we looking at? That why is it doing that? Why would a reflection actually make my reception or the performance of the RF system better?
Because you're dealing with the higher you go in frequency, the wavelengths get very short. So you need more power to deliver. However, since they're so short, they're bouncing around more. So they actually propagate differently, and in certain technologies, higher frequency stuff, I've done some work with things in 60 gigahertz, and we actually, when you're talking about stuff up in 60 gigahertz, you actually kind of rely on the reflections as well as the direct to help that stuff work.
So I want to get to more about these frequencies in just a moment, but I want to remind everybody that they are listening to The Live Life on AV Nation. With us today, that was Cliff Pospisil, an RF engineer, who's speaking with us. We also have with us today Ben Escobedo from Sennheiser, Mike Weber from Peter Schmidt, Christopher Regan from RF Venue, Andrew Guberman from World Stage, Mike Postapuck, my host, and I am George Tucker. Thank you for listening, by the way. So, Ben, I'm going to throw this to you for a moment. Frequencies.
Sure.
We just threw out a whole bunch of frequencies here. If you've been doing this for a while, you may have sort of been stuck in the idea that it's UHF. You know, you read your textbook and it's these certain frequency sets in the 400 to 800 range or whatever. But the new thing that we've thrown around as well is DTV. And DTV changes how we've done things in the past, right? So white spaces, as it's called, these little gaps between what used to be color and picture and sound, these three transmitters that came off of TV antennas, are now gone, right?
Well, not necessarily. We talk about white spaces, and we've always used white spaces, and we define it as the space in between television stations where it's the signal is so weak or there's not an active station there that we can actually occupy that chunk of spectrum. In the U.S., we have 6 megahertz blocks, and say channel 31 is being used, and channel 32 is open, and 33 is being used. 32 would be the way to go and what we would use. We used to be able to do is, like you mentioned, the picture and the sound carrier would not necessarily occupy the whole chunk of 6 megahertz. We might be able to sneak a microphone or two or three in between there where there's a lower part of that signal. Unfortunately, with digital TV, it pretty much takes up the whole 6 megahertz block, and there's no way around it. So you're pretty much either getting stomped on or you're not, and that's where the challenge lies. for the most part, there are other frequencies we operate at. You know, VHF mics you mentioned earlier were the earlier ones, and UHF is one of the most popular. There's upper 2.4 gigahertz and so forth, ISM band. The main thing is that the 700 megahertz, which obviously we don't have anymore due to the digital dividend, was the sweet spot between power and range transmission. You can send a signal the farthest amount of distance with the least amount of output power, hence why it's very valuable real estate, kind of like beachfront property in the RF world, and hence why it was auctioned off to the telecom companies and they wanted it so greatly. So mainly we are using the white spaces still, but you know, it's kind of a different world now, and we're ever shrinking spectrum, so making more efficient use of that spectrum is at the top priority, certainly.
So Mike Weber, Ben mentioned, and so did Cliff at certain points, the 2.4 gigahertz range. And most of us who even have a passing knowledge of RF know that that's Wi-Fi or Bluetooth and all the rest of that stuff. That's a problem, isn't it?
Well, not really when it comes to this, the RF band that most of us are using in the professional wireless world. We're mostly operating between 470 and 698. The 2.4 gig band, which isn't just Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, by the way, there's another protocol called Zigbee, which is related but different. And it is also possible, there are some companies that are using the 2.4 gigahertz band for wireless audio. So we can't ignore that, but that's not where the bulk of professional wireless radio frequencies are being used. Is that what you were looking for?
Yes. Yes. And my, okay. You know, my way of asking the question without trying to give an answer was, is this a concern and what do we do? And you've answered that, you know, in general, except for, I guess, what proximity and noise floor, unless it's a really powerful commercial system, it's really an irrelevant issue for most wireless mic systems.
That's correct. The main things are, as Ben mentioned, avoiding the digital TV channels, but those are fixed for the most part. That's fairly easy. And given if you know the zip code or the city that you're in, those don't change very often. They do change from, you know, the FCC is constantly approving new low power stations, or in some cases approving changes in power levels for existing TV stations. So you have to be aware of that. But they change very rarely. What's more likely is that you'll get maybe another wireless user in a nearby space that you weren't aware of, or two-way communications, that sort of thing. When you're in New York City, it's very common. If you're in a theater, there might be a theater next door. If you're in a business space, a conference room, there may be a business on another floor. And RF does go through walls and ceilings to some extent, so we have to be aware of that.
Yeah, just to add, with respect to 2.4 gigahertz and its location in wireless audio, years ago, when the first 2.4 gig systems they were pretty lousy. And they kind of fell flat. And we've seen in just the past few years the introduction of some much better frequency agile technology, meaning they jump channels on the go and can hold audio very and can hold signal and audio very consistently. Line 6 has in this area, as does CoachCom, that does the athletic market, and ClearCom with the Tempest system. But you know, those trade-offs are certainly there. One of the really attractive parts from the manufacturer's perspective is 2.4 gig band is an approved, you know, license-free channel in 170 something countries. So you can actually, instead of producing, you know, see transmitters that have different bands and different groups, you can make one product and, you know, be able to take that around wherever and use it. So it's attractive for a lot of reasons, but certainly challenging for a whole host of others.
Well, we're getting close to the end of the show here, but I wanted to ask one more question about the white space thing, because I remember reading about some of the concerns when the FCC decided to do this, and they came up with the whole idea of having units identify each other, identify other manufacturers' frequencies, and avoid each other. Where are we on that? Is that really happening? Is it implemented yet? What's going on with that? And I'll throw that to Ben.
Well, yes, it is in its infancy, and there is what we call TV band devices or TV DBs, and one of the first proof of concepts from companies such as Microsoft, who wished to use the white spaces that wireless microphones were using for so long for their own point-to-point communications, whether it's internet or bringing internet out to rural areas and such, was to automatically detect and shut down. What they found is that these devices weren't reliably able to detect wireless microphone use. They would either detect it when it wasn't there or vice versa. So the FCC recently has gone in the way of a registration program. If you are a professional wireless microphone user, you can register up to 1 year in advance on select websites to tell the FCC and other companies that, hey, I'm going to be using wireless microphones in this context at this time, at this venue, with this many channels on these specific frequencies. And these devices are supposed to acknowledge that fact from the database and stay clear of wireless microphones. We have precedent in that. There's also a few select what we call reserve channels per city that the FCC has allocated for wireless microphone use where TV band devices are not supposed to be used. What it comes down to is that since the 700 megahertz is gone now and the spectrum is shrinking and they want to share it with other devices, that we're becoming more and more hungry for bandwidth and space, and we really have to be on our toes about what frequencies we're using and what devices we're competing against. Yeah.
You know, I'd really like to ask, where is all this going, do you think? I mean, will it ever be easy to set up 50 wireless units and not have a problem?
Well, man, there are
a lot easier now.
And there are some new solutions. Both Sennheiser and Shure are coming out with new products. One new product from Shure is actually able to locate or detect interference and avoid it. It's still a pretty expensive proposition right now, but we do have a wireless product. It's called Axient, and it involves a scanner that is independent of the actual receivers. As Cliff mentioned, the receivers are capable of scanning. Hello? Did you lose me?
No, we're here.
Okay. And anyway, so we have this device called the Spectrum Manager that's able to scan your RF environment, monitor available frequencies in addition to the ones that you're already using. It can maintain a list of compatible frequencies. And in the event that one of the receivers detects interference, it can request and receive a new frequency from the Spectrum Manager and hop to that frequency in less than 100 milliseconds. It's a pretty cool technology.
Very cool. Well, that is all the time we have today on the Live Life. I want to thank our very special guest. This is really educational, and I appreciate it. Right. We had Ben Escobado from Sennheiser, Mike Weber from Peter Schmidt, Cliff Pospisil, he's an RF engineer, former Scharf Weisberg guy, Christopher Regan from RF Venue, and Andrew Guberman from World Stage, the sponsor of this lovely show, whom we love very much. Thank you, Josh. And my co-host, Mike Postapuck. Mike, any final words?
I don't know. Get to work.
Get to work. Exactly. It is the busy season. It started. Well, that's it for today. This has been The Live Life. We look forward to talking to you guys soon.